The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. More proof that Ronaldo is ruining this Manchester United team and then rescuing it at the same time. It's so confusing. Another flat performance from Ole's men, saved by Bruno's back heel and Cristiano's injury time heroics. At what point does he become a good signing? Elsewhere in the Champions League, an easy 1-0 for Chelsea. Juve and Bayern book their places in the last 16, and Fati scores the winner for Barca. Meanwhile, Conte arrives in North London. What's happened there? Is this a brand new plan for Spurs, or will it implode within his 18-month contract? Also, Unai Emery doesn't want to try and get a tune out of Joe Linton or Jonjo Shelvey, so where will Newcastle turn? That plus crisis at Everton, question mark, a Premier League preview, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, hello.
Morning.
Barry Glendening, hello.
Hi, Max.
And live from Bergamo, Jonathan Liu. Hi, mate.
Hi, Max. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. Thanks for asking. Patrick says, who's at the wheel? Rob says, is Ronaldo both the problem and the solution and the problem at United? Ronaldo's 138th and 139th Champions League goal, his 19th and 20th for Manchester United at the end of both halves. I'll start with you, Johnny. You were there. It seems like every week now, Wilson isn't here. So like, we won't necessarily have someone saying Ronaldo's a terrible signing, but we say Ronaldo's a terrible signing. And yet he was also really important for Manchester United.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some of the guys who cover United on a weekly basis, and you know, they're just kind of at a loss. Like, how do we continue writing about this incredibly stupid football team that just, you know, does really daft things and then keeps you know, bailing themselves out. You know, on Ronaldo, I think seen in isolation, he has been probably quite a coup, quite a success, and certainly in terms of creating spectacular moments for United since he rejoined them. But you know, you can't really look at these things in isolation. I mean, I don't think he is the problem. I don't think he is the root of the problem, because obviously United were quite a dysfunctional unit before he arrived. He has sort of exacerbated a lot of the structural issues in that team since he joined, in the sense that, you know, you have to kind of build your team around him, and when you have, you know, four or five other you know, really good attacking players who can run, then, you know, you are kind of you are slightly hamstrung. But then, you know, this is the eternal paradox. It's like that Simpsons line about beer being the, you know, cause of and solution to everybody's problems. The other thing actually is, I think there was a marked difference in between how Ronaldo has played in the Champions League, where I think he's scored in every game so far, and his Premier League form. It's kind of almost as if he's made a calculation that, you know, okay, this side are not going to win the league. How am I going to burnish my legacy here? And he thinks, well, the Champions League, this is, you know, he really, really doesn't want to play in the Europa League. I think that would be kind of a blow to his ego. But he sort of thinks that maybe there is, you know, the only way he can really win something big at United and make it worth his while is by inspiring them to, you know, just lifting this side to Champions League glory. And you can kind of see that in the, you know, he was a lot better than he has been in a lot of his recent league games.
I did wonder, Barry, if, because we've decided, you know, it has been decided that Solskjaer is not a tactician and doesn't know what he's doing, that when you see that move, right, the first goal for United, where that, you know, that Bruno Fernandes back heel, which I think I've given 7.1 on the Guti gauge of just glorious assists, is such a beautiful goal that if Liverpool had scored it or City had scored it, we'd have said, look, this is classic Guardiola football. This is classic Klopp football. I mean, I know you've got 88 minutes either side of these goals to like come back, but does that make any sense?
A little bit, I suppose. But the weight of overwhelming evidence suggests that's not a move that was particularly worked on in the training ground. They didn't like walk through it, then run through it, then run through it with opposition, and keep practicing until it were. That looks like just something that was conjured out of thin air by brilliant players. that's, you know, I could be wrong, but the weight of evidence on what the rest of Manchester United's play suggests that's probably the case. And it was a terrific goal, a wonderful goal. And it just shows, you know, with quick, sharp passing, incise, they just ripped the Atalanta defence apart, carved it open. On the Ronaldo thing, I did see Wilson churning out his greatest hits on your Australian show. A wallpaper analogy I think I might have heard somewhere before. I mean, that man must be loving this because he's just getting money for rope at this stage, churning out the same spiel time after time after time, which is kind of indicative of United's problems. And if it's not for Ronaldo's goals, they're out of the group already. But if Ronaldo wasn't in the team, would they need those goals, those last-ditch goals to save their bacon constantly? My feeling is, if he wasn't there, if he'd gone to City in a parallel universe, someone else would be getting the goals and they wouldn't need somebody to be stepping up with, you know, last-minute miracle goals. And, yeah, I haven't learned anything about Manchester United in the last 24 hours that, you know, nothing has swayed me either way. I just feel the same about them. What happens if they beat City at the weekend? What happens if they get a result? They may get absolutely annihilated, and then it's very entertaining, I have to say. But they can't possibly keep going like this, can they? I mean, if they end up winning the Champions League, we are like going this. To look like absolute clowns. So many people are going to look so stupid.
Nikki.
There was someone on Twitter, I'm afraid, I didn't write down who it was, so sorry, but someone on Twitter last night saying that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is like the maybe it was Grace Robertson, who's like the student who has perfected doing just enough work to not get in trouble at school, like just enough, the right amount to not get detention. But I just had to come back a little bit on what Barry said about Ronaldo, though, and if he wasn't there, would the team look better? And I think this is exactly the conversation that Juventus had. A lot of people were saying, well, hang on, is Ronaldo actually kind of stopping them from playing better football because everything's been done to accommodate him? And I mean, it's a chicken and egg thing going on because maybe they wouldn't look like this if Ronaldo hadn't been there for those years. But the truth is that he's gone. And while Juventus played well last night, in general, Juventus do not look better without Cristiano Ronaldo. They look like a team that doesn't have any sort of get out of jail card anymore and also doesn't have a plan. And I wouldn't be shocked if it was the same thing with Manchester United. I don't think that you can assume that they would suddenly be better in their fluidity if he wasn't there.
Atalanta, Nikki, must feel slightly confused as how they've only taken 1 point from these two football matches.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the expected goals and all that stuff from last night, Atalanta were the better team. They had more of the ball. I thought Duván Zapata was brilliant. I love him on nights like this. He can be so compelling. The way he uses his body to manipulate defenders, to get position on people. I think he's wonderful when he's on song like that. And I think there've been two really courageous performances against Manchester United because even in this game, they did get Jim City back for part of this game, but you're still talking about a team that's been missing most of its defence. It's got Martin Deroon starting out of position in that back line and indeed was, I think, the player who lost Ronaldo on that first goal. They've got other players who are out of form. I think Luis Muriel coming off the bench, the version of Muriel that we saw last season would have been far more impactful, but the one who's out there at the moment really has been struggling and didn't, I think, make the right impact off the bench. I think Gasperini made some really smart changes in the way that he tried to deal with Fernandes in the second half. But in the end, Ronaldo stopped them from winning this game. And I think they're still very much in this group. But I think if you put this together with the Villarreal game, which they also felt like they could have won at the start of the group, there's definitely some feeling of missed opportunity in terms of the position after four games.
That Zapata goal, Johnny, obviously you're in the stadium, probably didn't have a clue what was going on. We didn't have a clue what was going on because they don't show the lines. I think UEFA don't show the lines. And I think that might have been going on for a while. But didn't we all hate seeing the lines? And now we hate not seeing the lines. So I don't know what What am I meant to like in these decisions?
I think what people really hated was like people hated seeing the lines being drawn, like somebody with a little cursor and clicking on a player's armpit, and I think that felt a little bit like too much information. But now we've gone to the other extreme. I think Premier League have it about right, where they show the kind of the final line. They show the lines, but they don't show how the lines were made. There was no replays in the stadium. Actually, there was one replay. They showed one replay in the stadium before the VAR check was initiated. And from that, I was fairly clear that Zapata was onside. So, it seemed like a fairly simple decision to me, even though the Atalanta players had all gone back to their own halves and they were all getting ready to kick off. It looked like a goal on that one replay. I think it's this kind of pregnant period of time where nothing is happening and nobody knows what's happening and nobody kind of knows, what machinations are happening and what kind of decisions are being taken. That's the sort of, that's the dead space that football really needs to sort out, because the Atalanta fans started sort of chanting like, go fuck yourself VAR or something like that. It was vaf, something VAR. And that's just really bad. It's really bad television. It's really bad product, and I think that's the main flaw with the system at the moment.
Another in defense of Solskjaer type point, which probably isn't a valid point again, is that players sometimes play well or they play badly. So if Manchester United say Eric Bailly actually seemed to have a very good game, or he made a lot of very good last ditch tackles, possibly because he was in the wrong place in the first place, I'm not sure, but like Maguire and Pogba didn't have good games. Now is that, whose fault is that? Or is that just because sometimes players don't play well and sometimes they do play well?
I think Maguire is in a poor run of form. His confidence looks pretty shot. Probably not helped by Roy Keane's evisceration of him on Sky recently.
I don't think he's fully fit.
Yeah, possibly.
And actually, do you think about the Euro? I mean, people sort of saying Luke Shaw looks a bit leggy. Obviously, Harry Kane is not fit. Calvin Phillips was injured. There's a lot of players that have come from, I don't know how many England players who played a lot of those Euros games who are having brilliant seasons at the moment. Someone could.
Well, whatever the reason for his poor form, if it's because he's not fit, then if he's not fit, don't play him. So the responsibility for that presumably lies at the manager's door. Paul Pogba, he's never been consistent for Manchester United. Personally, I think he's stealing a living there, but on his day, he is, of course, capable of much better than we saw last night. But yeah, it's not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's fault that David De Gea let in a soft goal. It's not his fault that Pogba... Well, but Paul Scholes made an interesting point on BT last night, actually. He was saying that he thinks the reason Pogba's so good for France but not as good for Manchester United is that he basically, it's almost like he's a child with attention deficit disorder. He can't concentrate for any length of time and he needs a senior player alongside him constantly in his ear telling him what to do, where to be, and to give him a rocket if required. And that he doesn't have anyone to do that at Manchester United, whereas in Juventus there were lots of players who could, he had to defer to. So that sounds like it could be a decent theory, but I can't help but think Manchester United would probably be better off without him.
Matt says, why is Gasperini never linked for any big jobs, Nicky?
Well, he had a big job at Inter and it went catastrophically badly. I can't remember exactly how many games he lasted, but it was about five. He got that job and it was when Massimo Moratti was still the owner, and immediately the Milan press, because we were in a different era, the Milan press immediately decided that it was completely ridiculous that a big team with big aspirations could play with a back three, which of course everyone is doing now. And he got chased out of town very quickly after some bad early results. And I dare say that he's been a bit stung by that experience and is very aware that in Atalanta he's onto a good thing, that he's got a lot of authority. Actually, he had this nickname. I haven't actually heard this nickname for a while, but it was always the old nickname with Gasperini, was Gasperson. Bit of a weird way of spelling it, but the idea in Italy was that this was his, because he's like Ferguson, again, bit of a sort of slightly odd Gasperson Ferguson thing. But
I think you meant like gas person, just mad gas, mad with terrible wind or something.
But because he's someone who, in the Italian narrative, because Italian coaches tend to be just coaches, right? And you've always had the model of director of sport, which is now more prevalent over here, but wasn't a few years ago. And I think at Atalanta, he absolutely has that authority over lots of things. He has wide-reaching control, and he's been able to build consistent success there, even sort of accepting that the club model is to sell players, to let people go. He's managed to make something that works for him. They've been in the Champions League year after year, and his team is, frankly, playing on an even footing with Manchester United over two games, even if in the end they only got a draw out of them, despite far smaller resources. So I think the answer is, at this point in his career, he might just not fancy it. But he has had that job. He had it at Inter, and it went so badly for him. I wonder if that changed his outlook on whether to take future opportunities, and when he found something good, whether to stick with it. Barry said before it wasn't Solskjaer's fault that De Gea let in a soft goal, and that's true. But I do think, on that, since we're talking about Gasperini, I thought Gasperini solidly outcoached Solskjaer last night. I thought in the second half the changes were far better on Atalanta's side. I thought in the first half they controlled the play and set the tempo with this sort of alternating pattern of holding the ball deep and then looking for those longer direct balls when they wanted to. Manchester United were really in this game bailed out by Cristiano Ronaldo. And you could say over two games, it's kind of the same story as the first one, really.
Manchester United, Villarreal, both on 7 points. Atalanta on 5. Young Boys on 3. Villarreal beat Young Boys 2-0. A touch of the relegated Premier Leagues about this win. Etienne Capoue going from relegated with Watford to being man of the match in the Europa League final, scoring in the Champions League. And Dan Juma as well, scoring with a minute to go. A former Bournemouth player. Young Boys had a goal disallowed for offside. The player was in the, you know, struggling from the Harvey Barnes effect of just not getting out of the way. And it probably was the right decision because the goalkeeper could punch him in the head instead of getting the ball. Grant says, if Newcastle appoint a manager just before you finish recording, what dairy product will you be discussing? Apparently, Unai Emery has turned down the chance to be the next Newcastle manager. This is according to Guillaume Balaguer on the BBC. There was a lack of a clear vision from the club. If you want him, do you approach him in such a rushed way without an official offer and with it coming out of the English side that it's all practically done? I don't see this happening now this season. Apparently, Emery had talks with Villarreal last night and he wants to stay there. So now, Baz, what happens next? Eddie Howe? Fonseca? Who?
I don't know. Newcastle, it's well, I suppose their second big decision after they made a bit of a mess of their first one, and they look like they're making a dog's breakfast of this too. They seem to be in a big rush to leak the fact that Emery was going to take the job. I don't think he appreciated that, particularly on a day when he was preparing his Villarreal side for a Champions League match. All the signs yesterday coming out of Newcastle were that he was going to take the job. Whether or not he'd have been the right choice, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure Newcastle fans would approach his conservative approach to games, considering how much they loathed Steve Bruce's conservative approach. But I think his track record, his win percentage, the trophies he's won, and the fact that he's not Steve Bruce would have stood him in great stead. He's not a great communicator. I was at a few of his Arsenal press conferences, and I say this as someone who doesn't have a word of Spanish, so I'm not in any position to criticise his poor grasp of English, but you were always left after these press conferences going, I have no idea what he was talking about there. And journalists would kind of convene after he'd left the room and try to agree, you know, on what it is we thought he'd said. So, you know, we wouldn't all be quoting entirely different things.
I had that once. I had that once at a major murder trial, where when I was a court reporter, when the jury stood up, you know, the foreman or whatever he's called, they said, "Have you reached a verdict?" And we'd all been there for weeks. And, you know, they're there with a crime reporter from Sky News and Channel 4 News and BBC, whatever. And they, "Have you reached a verdict?" And the foreman went, "We have, Your Honour." And then one bloke at the other end of the jury went, "No, we haven't." not entirely relevant.
Going back to the question.
Yes, yes.
If they go for Eddie Howe now, we're in Spurs territory where whoever gets the job knows they're not first choice. They know they're not second choice. They might not even be third choice. So it's not a great start by Newcastle's new owners.
Well, there does seem to be kind of a gulf between what the sort of manager Newcastle are trying to attract right now and the sort of manager they actually need right now. I mean, Emery is a good manager. I think he actually would have been a decent choice for Spurs. He's got experience at the league and his size have played decent football. You know, Fonseca is a kind of he plays nice attacking football. I'm sure the fans will warm to him. You know, all this kind of airy talk about, you know, Lucien Favre or you know, whatever. But what they need right now is someone who can get a really, really bad group of players out of the Premier League relegation zone. It's a job for, you know, I don't know, it's a job for Tony Pulis or Roy Hodgson at the moment. And surely, you know, if you're an aspirant manager looking at that squad, with the level of expectation that's going to be leveled on you, being like the first new manager under the new ownership, but in those circumstances with those players, you're kind of on a hiding to nothing. It's going to be far easier to be the second manager after this manager. And, you know, so what they need first and foremost is someone who can keep them in the division. And, you know, I mean, I'm being slightly, you know, mischievous with Tony Pulis, but he's kind of that's what they need right now. They need someone who can organise a defence.
Could they get them all? Could they go, like the Expendables, get Allardyce, Pulis, Warnock, get them all there and just sit, like, just you know, why not? It'd be great fun.
There is a manager who can organise a defence and has just found himself out of work. And if I were a Newcastle fan, I'd be biting my hand off for Nuno Espirito Santo right now.
And we will discuss Nuno and Antonio Conte at the start of part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, the Football Supporters Association Awards. The nominations have been announced and Football Weekly has been nominated. And I don't know what you think, Barry, but look, we put a lot of effort into this pod. We haven't won for, what, 2 years?
Yeah, Peter Crouch has given us a kicking for a couple of years.
So it is about time you voted for us, or maybe we'll stop doing it. That's what I think. At We Are the FSA, or you can go to thefsa.org.uk and you can vote for Football Weekly. You can also vote for Jonathan Liu as best writer, or Jonathan Wilson, whoever you prefer.
Or Susie.
Or Susie Rack, of course. Yeah, my apologies. You can vote for David Squires as well. You can vote for The Guardian as a whole. You can vote for nothing to do with The Guardian, but a radio show that I do, and Barry is also on, but he doesn't get named, and neither does Charlie Baker, which is not fair. And you can vote for Ali McCoist, who has no connection to any of this whatsoever, but he is the best. Mark says, "Was I wrong to vote for you in that awards thingamajig, even though I've never heard a single episode of the pod?" Absolutely not, Mark. And I don't know why I'm talking to you since you don't listen to this. Right, let's talk about Antonio Conte then. Been confirmed as Tottenham's new manager on a £15 million a year contract to June 2023 with an option to extend. Watson says, "What are all the Chelsea and Arsenal fans going to do with themselves when we win the league next season?" This Tottenham optimism. Nikki, what are your thoughts about Conte going to Spurs?
My first feeling, honestly, was I was really surprised. Obviously, he did turn down that option in the summer. And I always come back to this thing you said before about wherever he goes, he has to believe there's some chance of winning. And, you know, as he put it, when he joined Inter, it can be 1%, but there has to be some genuine chance that he thinks he can win. Now, of course, he might set the bar differently at Tottenham. He might not be winning the league, but he wants to believe he can win something. And given that Tottenham are 13 years without a trophy, it's a statement to take that job. And it's even more of a statement if he thinks that there's some possibility that that Manchester United job could come available at some point. And to a certain extent, I think that's probably the conversation that that Paratici has had with Daniel Levy, is if we leave this much longer to try and make this move, he's going to have that opportunity at Manchester United. Whereas if we make the move right now, maybe he's just bored enough of being not working. He's never really taken jobs in the middle of seasons like this before, but I'm guessing Paratici has had some conversations with him. They obviously know each other going back a very long way, and had got the impression that actually, yes, he just wants to be working and to be doing his thing again. I can see lots of things within this setup that would appeal to Conte. I know everyone makes a joke about Tottenham having the lovely new stadium and not the results go with it, but I think that is an appeal to him. They've got a great setup. They've got a great training ground. I think the fact of Harry Kane, someone who he's spoken about glowingly before, being there and being this opportunity for a reclamation project, he's just shown with Romelu Lukaku that he can get more out of centre forwards who fit his mould, which I think Kane really does, by the way, than some others might. I think that pairing of Son and Kane should be alluring to any manager, at least in terms of their talent. I know Kane has been off the boil this season. But I also think right through that team, there's pieces that fit what I imagine he'll do, the classic Conte 3-5-2. I think Christian Romero hasn't shown his best since joining from Atalanta, but he's very much thrived in the middle of a back three at Atalanta. I think you've got two wing-backs in Emerson Royal and Reguilon that are very much players who, again, fit that formation that you can expect him to play. And I'm certain, on top of all of this, that he at least thinks he's been told there's going to be some money spent in January. I'm certain that's the case. I don't believe Conte accepts his job without that impression. Whether or not what Daniel Levy has said and what Antonio Conte has heard are the same thing.
Is it a gentleman's agreement?
But I'm certain that he believes there's going to be money spent in January, because that's the other thing which, you know, needs to be said about Conte. Funnily enough, I think sometimes he does his best work when he's not given what he wants. I think the second half of last season at Inter, he was very unhappy about no money being spent in January, but he had to, I think we talked about this on the podcast, he had to go and play with the toys that he already had. He had to go and get Eriksen and Perisic and say, all right, well, we're going to do something different, and got really great results from it. But he does expect money to be spent. He always expects clubs to match his ambition, and there will be, on his part, I'm 100% sure of this, he'll be expecting that he'll get some transfers according to his vision in January.
Spurs official Twitter account posted, "Bienvenido a Tottenham Hotspur, Antonio Conte," which is Spanish, which is tremendous. Johnny, what do you make of it all?
I think it's a real coup for Spurs. I mean, this has been said elsewhere, but you know, to make the kind of the missteps and the bad decisions they have over the last couple of years, and to end up, you know, at the end of it with Antonio Conte as their manager is quite some safety net. I think they'll see, you know, they will see a pretty immediate improvement. I think you know, Nicky is right, that Spurs squad is just set up for a 5-3-2, and you know, could do with, you know, some organisation and just a little bit of energy. I think the energy in the stadium and the energy on the pitch has been just really flat over the last few weeks. Like the big, I guess, the X factor, you know, the big 64,000, you know, euro question is Kane. You know, he's there for this season. It's pretty clear he doesn't want to be there in the long term. Can you build a side around him, knowing that, you know, he might not be there next season and he wants out? And if you're trying to build something over 2 or 3 years, you know, that's just something that they don't really know. And Conte famously is not a manager who enjoys having his best striker being sold from under him. So whether there have been some kind of you know, assurances on that score, I don't know. But this has the potential to. I don't think Conte is, like, you know, there's no such thing as a guaranteed, you know, trophy manager. They tried this with Mourinho, and I don't think Conte is in the Mourinho league, but he is very definitely positioning himself for his next job. he's clearly not in this for like a 4-year project. He wants to kind of, he wants some sort of bankable success that he can show in the next couple of seasons that will commend him to his next potential employer. And there's always, you know, there was slight dangers in that situation where maybe, you know, you have a manager who feels he's slightly too big for the club, or a club that is just really grateful to get this manager. And you know, from the start, you have this kind of inequality of status that you know, can cause problems. But I think there'll be lots of successes in the short term. And I think for Spurs fans, there just isn't the appetite for a rebuild at the moment. They want some chocolate, and they've got some chocolate.
I just think I find the parallels with what Conte took over at Inter really compelling. Now, obviously, there's big differences. Inter were on the up, had gone back into the Champions League places under Luciano Spalletti, but nevertheless, they were in a great sense this sort of you know, this banter club for Italian football for a long time. Since the Mourinho treble, they had not won the title. They'd spent a lot of money to go backwards at times, and one of the first things he did was to say, right, we're not going to play the club anthem, which long predated that era, the Pazza Inter anthem, which is literally played before kickoff, and you know, talks about how it's great to support Inter because everything's crazy, basically. And he said, we're not going to be crazy, we're going to be credible. And he repeated this word credible over and over again, especially in that first season. I think it's a really interesting sort of parallel that's what Tottenham want to be, I think, most of all right now. They want to be credible again. And I think he is a manager who brings you that instant credibility. And of course, Johnny's right. Like, you're not, even though we talk about someone going somewhere and winning every time, that's only true until it isn't. And maybe this will be the stop where it isn't. But the thing that actually I think is most sort of challenging, because I do believe that squad and Conte is a very good combination. I think he can take them somewhere. The challenge is Conte is really specific in the way that he asks his teams to play. He's quite rigid. And I think his sort of view is that you teach these very rigid mechanisms to your players, and after a while, that the certainty of those mechanisms is what gives them confidence. Once they understand precisely where each other's going to be, that gives them confidence. And then you get some sort of real quality comes off that, because then they can start showing the flair and the creativity within that structure. But that is where we come back to this thing of, he doesn't normally take jobs in the middle of seasons, because if you want to have very specific mechanisms, very sort of tight ways of playing that are very structured, you kind of need time to build that in. And how does that happen when you're already in November and you've got no time to sort of stop and bang everyone's heads together? Maybe it will be that he can do it on the fly and once again sort of prove to us that he's a brilliant manager, because he is a brilliant manager, in my opinion. I think he's really one of the best in the world right now. But it's definitely a different context, that mid-season arrival, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
I wonder if Christian Eriksen is healthy. I know he can't play in Italy, but I think he could play in England. And I wonder how... He didn't get on with Conte at the start, but he did by the end. He was quite important to Inter by the end. And Spurs really lack creativity. And, you know, obviously the most important thing is that he's fine. But, you know, if he's sort of past fit to play, I wonder if that could possibly, you know, be a solution for everybody. Because if he was fit, it'd be, you know, the Spurs fans would be just delighted to see him again, I think.
I had the same thought about Eriksen, actually. Great minds and all that. The other thing that I suppose hasn't been covered, there's quite a few players not really getting a look in at the Tottenham first team. Matt Doherty, Dele at the moment, and Joe Roden are three that spring to mind. And will they be surplus to requirements? Will they be... get a chance to be rejuvenated under Conte? It will be interesting to see.
Yeah, well, Nuno apparently is getting £12 million payoff. Amadeus says, on payoffs, if I started a job on a fixed-term 2-year contract for a normal employer and I was tasked with the job of digitizing Big Ben, which is the example. I'm not sure what normal employer that is. And 3 months into my post, I did nothing but eat burritos and film TikTok dances. I'd get sacked. And I doubt I'd get the rest of my 2 years' salary as some sort of compensation. Why are football managers different? I mean, they sign contracts, don't they? And, you know, if you're a manager, you make sure you get that written in. But, you know, I really hope, Amadeus, that one day when I get back in London in June and I'm cycling to meet Baz for a pint, I look up at Big Ben and it's a big Casio digital watch just there beeping away. Baskerville says Nuno looked sad when he was trying to do his football manager job, especially with a crowd of people screaming that he didn't know what he was doing. Then he got sacked. How would Barry try to raise Nuno's spirits if he could take him on a day out?
I'd just go to the pub, play pool, drink. If there was a game on, watch that. Kasabian are on in Brixton Academy tonight. I could get him in there. Use my connections to get him in for free. He might enjoy a bit of shoot the runner, or I'm on fire. And I think I'd take him to a local restaurant for fritters and hot wings. We'd have an enjoyable day out. I would send him home drunk and content.
I'd take him to the zoo. It's physically impossible to be sad and morose and looking at an alpaca at the same time. And also, if you're in London Zoo, my favourite thing to do in London Zoo is to go to the vulture enclosure and go in there and look around and point at them and go, "Vultures! All of you, vultures!" No.
That's about Nuno. Maybe Nuno would. That's possible. He would join in with you. In Group H in the Champions League, Chelsea won 1-0 at Malmo. Hakim Ziyech is now the joint highest Moroccan goal scorer in the Champions League alongside Marouane Chamakh. Malmo played okay in the first half, but really Chelsea, you know, sort of battered them 1-0. Hudson-Odoi's cross was beautiful. Dan says, please discuss how Tuchel can integrate every member of his squad into the first team. United can't give by Van der Beek, Sancho again. That is something that Tuchel is doing brilliantly, is to give Ross Barkley minutes and Loftus-Cheek and, you know, Alonso's in the side for a bit, then Chilwell's in the side for a bit. There doesn't seem to be any manager who does it as well as him, Johnny, just to give everybody, to get everybody as part of the squad.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real skill of Tuchel. And, you know, as well as being, you know, a great tactician and being able to set up a team well, he's a great squad manager. You know, there was a lot of talk earlier in the season. Well, you know, Ben Chilwell's been frozen out, and you know, well, Marcus Alonso's got his place, and you know, what's happening to Ben Chilwell? And you know, it turns out, and certainly if you listen to Chilwell, you know, speaking these days, he was always, you know, he was always part of the plan, and Tuchel always kind of made him feel like, you know, this is going to be a really long season for us and we're going to need you at this point. And, you know, there's a real kind of skill with, you know, and some people will say one of the biggest skills of management is in managing the players who aren't playing in the squad. And, you know, their kind of help that their system is so, I think it's such a malleable system. You know, they can go four at the back, they can go five at the back, they can play, you know, two up front, one up front, you know, nobody up front. And all the pieces still seem to kind of fit. And that's kind of an advantage of the squad that Chelsea have been able to assemble. But yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the skill of management, right?
Also in the group, Juve beat Zenit 4-2. Eric says, can Nicky explain the dichotomy of Juve in Serie A versus the Champions League? 100% record, got to the knockout stages. Dybala had a wonderful game. Chiesa looked great as well. Lots of fun in this game.
Yeah, it's like someone's put a mirror next to Juventus and we've got their mirror image version this season, because normally it's the other way around, right? Europe is always Juventus's disappointing area and domestically they're fine. And this season we've got terrible domestic Juventus, but we've got a Juventus who are, as you say, perfect in four games in Europe. It obviously helped having Federico Chiesa back in this game. He was absolutely on fire on that left wing. And I think it's kind of a reminder that actually in this post-Ronaldo era, he is the standout talent. He's the one who really makes magic happen. Everyone, I think, wants Dybala to be a standout talent like that. And while we see it at times with Dybala, and actually he overtook Michel Platini on the club's all-time scoring lists and did an homage celebration lying on his side in a Platini pose a famous Platini pose from an Intercontinental Cup game. Dybala's always been very frustrating in his intermittent way of coming through, whereas Chiesa continues to look very special to me. But yeah, it's an interesting situation for Juventus. And in fact, when I sort of make that throwaway line about it being the opposite of how we expect Juventus to be, it is of course true when we talk about when Conte left Juventus and Allegri replaced him. They did keep winning domestically, but the big difference at first was that Allegri actually took them to two European finals. So he has got a little bit in Italy, they often just use the English word feeling for this competition.
Nice of Dybala to pay homage to Platini on the day when he's charged with fraud and other offences by Swiss prosecutors on Tuesday, along with Sepp Blatter. When Morata scored, did he do an impression of Sepp Blatter, or did Sepp not? It's nothing. No one did an impression of Sepp.
Because Sepp Blatter had a movie, didn't he? Made about himself, and he's.
Oh yes, who's played him? Sam Neill?
Tim Roth.
It was Tim Roth.
Tim Roth.
Did he have an iconic celebration? Because of course I know he fancied himself as a great centre forward. Did he have like a Ronaldo-esque sue? Did he have a celebration move?
I don't know. The fishing rod, maybe, or sort of throwing wads of cash. Anyway, I'd like to officially apologise to Sam Neill, because I just don't... Was Sam Neill in that movie? If he wasn't, he seems like a lovely man, and I wouldn't want to associate him with a movie like that. Anyway, just on this, Blatter and Platini face trial within months at a federal criminal court in Bellinzona.
I get he was in it. Sam, you need to take back your apology to Sam Neill.
Oh, Sam Neill was he? I retract my apology to Sam Neill, and may he is not welcome on this podcast. I'd like to make it official. Blatter's been charged with fraud, mismanagement, misappropriation of FIFA funds, and forgery of a document. Platini's been charged with fraud, misappropriation, forgery, and as an accomplice to Blatter's alleged mismanagement. Platini was not placed under formal investigation until last year. A month later, the more serious allegation of fraud was included against both men. Prosecutors had opened criminal proceedings against Blatter in September 2015, ahead of a police raid at FIFA headquarters in Zurich on the day he and Platini attended a meeting of the governing body's executive committee. In Group E, Bayern hammered Benfica 5-2. Lewandowski scored a hat trick. One of them was a beautiful first touch and little dink. Serge Gnabry scored a lovely back heel.
That was Lewandowski's 100th Champions League appearance as well. So a nice way to mark it for him.
Very well done. 81 goals in 100 games. He also hit a terrible penalty. But that's okay when you score as many goals as he does. He's sort of ageless, Lewandowski, as well. And it sort of feels like he should be greying a bit at some point, but he's still very good. And Ansu Fati scored a winner for Barcelona, which means they're in second place in the group, which is pretty impressive considering after game one, when they were hammered by Bayern, we thought they might not get anywhere. And in Group G, Salzburg lead the way. Lille is second, Wolfsburg third, Sevilla fourth. But they've all got a chance of qualifying. Lille won 2-1 in Seville, and Wolfsburg beat Red Bull Salzburg 2-1. And that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Monday Night Football, however long it seemed to go, when Wolves beat Everton. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So on Monday, Wolves beat Everton 2-1. Wolves up to seventh, 2 points and three places above Everton, won 4-5. Everton, after that great point at Old Trafford, when we had Troy Townsend on telling us how brilliant Andros was, maybe a point at Old Trafford isn't that great after all. Since then, they've lost to West Ham, Watford, and now Wolves. And sort of rumours, Baz, or sort of that, you know, obviously Rafa has a bit of baggage, but that it's all gone, seems to be gone quite sour quite quickly.
I think you have to distinguish between internet Everton fans and Everton fans who actually go to games and live in Liverpool. My understanding was that, you know, when he was appointed, there was a big hoo-ha online on social media. We don't want him because he described us as a small club, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago, however long ago it was. But he couldn't have been made feel more welcome at Goodison Park when he was introduced for his first game. So there is that distinction. Everton's are fabled for their inconsistency. Their performances of late have not been good. I would be very surprised if there's a clamour to get rid of him at the moment. I'm not aware of one, that which is not to say there is one. But their performance, like the defensive errors against Wolves were, you know, really chaotic and not what you'd associate with a Rafa Benitez team. So I'd imagine he was absolutely furious. But maybe because of this baggage, it won't take long for them to lose patience with him. The support, anyway, whatever about the owners. I think it would be a mistake to cut him loose. But it is quite interesting what you said about good results at Old Trafford no longer being particularly indicative of a team being good, because we've got the exact same thing with Aston Villa.
No, it's true. John says, I don't know whether all clubs do this, but the Wolves players turn up to home games by coach. Does it go around the local neighbourhood picking up all the players like the school bus? It's a lovely image, isn't it? I mean, they think they all stay in a hotel now the night before, even for home games. But I do like the idea of the bus just, you know, beeping, and then, you know, Max Kilman's mum, you know, giving him his packed lunch, and then it's Fabio Silva, and then they go around the corner, and maybe two of them are together. If that is the case, please let us know. But it isn't the case. And Neil says, a question for Nicky Bandini, if I may, and the courtesy has granted the... Yeah, I'd like everybody to ask a question in such a polite way from this moment on, especially Sam Neil, if he has a question, given what he's done. I've been casually following Roma this year. Noticed that Tammy Abraham seemed to get a few boos at the weekend during the defeat to Milan. He seemed to start the year strongly. What's the feeling on his progress at the club?
Yeah, I don't think there's some sort of fan movement against him. I have to admit, I didn't pick up on those boos. But I'm not doubting they happened. I don't think that's a sort of universal sentiment. He definitely has lost form very sharply in the last few games. I think specifically at the weekend, they were really struggling to get service to him. But he hasn't been scoring. After starting so brightly, his goals haven't really come for him. And There's a lot in that. There's a lot to be unpacked, because, of course, Roma had a major humiliation in Europe against Bodo Glimt. They've struggled in their big games this season. Jose Mourinho has thrown half the squad under the bus, not including Tammy Abraham. Tammy Abraham is very much part of
the
core group. Yes, exactly. But
he's been picked up by the Wolves bus, the Roma bus.
Didn't Roma's owner come out in at the start of the week and make this kind of like demented statement about like refereeing conspiracies against them or something?
There's been a wholehearted buy-in to the Jose Mourinho worldview, I would say, and by the club and by fans as well. So for now, even though results aren't great, there's a lot of, people who are on board with everything Jose is saying, which does involve, yes, quite a lot of everyone's out to get us, and the referees are all thwarting us.
Steve says, was Ben Warman's strike the goal of the night? This is Cambridge's opening goal at Morecambe, and it is slightly biased of me to bring it up. His first goal in professional football on his second start. And it was absolutely brilliant. It sort of flicked it up on his left foot, a sort of ball, angled ball in from a deep position, and then volleyed it into the top left-hand corner. And then I was worried, Barry, that I'd set these rules about what an official volley was and you couldn't set yourself up. But this was absolutely a volley. So now I've tied myself in knots, having been so absolutely sure of myself about what a volley was.
Does it matter? It was just a really good goal.
No, you're probably right.
I didn't realise it was a Cambridge United player when I saw the clip he sent. But yeah, I'm saying it's a volley. But
people get very puritanical about volleys. You know, this is a pure volley. This isn't a proper volley. It can't be a volley if you know you've set yourself up, or it can't be a volley if you know if it's bounced. You know, and people get really angry about this kind of stuff. And
I did. I got angry when the Premier League said Paul Pogba had scored a volley where the ball had clearly bounced and then he'd struck it beautifully, but that didn't feel like a volley, whereas this feels like a volley. But now, when I'm now deconstructing it, I feel like a complete idiot for even caring at all. There are bigger things to worry about.
I mean, do you think it's like a symptom of how little kind of control and buy-in and input we have over the game itself, that we end up, you know, as fans, I mean, that we kind of end up tearing each other to shreds over things like what's a volley or not, or whether, you know, Manchester City's third kit is an abomination or not. People get really angry about this stuff because the stuff that we should actually be getting angry about, we can't really change. Or is that just too profound for part three?
Yeah, but it's also, well, no, I don't think it's too profound, but I think it's also not really getting angry, but, you know, just being a pedant, because that's kind of a fun part of being a football fan. And you're right, you don't want to spend the whole of your football fandom experience being really absolutely sort of sad about all the truly awful things that happen within the game. And so if I can get really excited by the collar on a shirt, or like the trim on some shorts, or how beautifully struck a goal was, a terrible goalmouth scramble where the ball doesn't go in, I'm using my time in actually a positive way, I think.
Yeah, but like yesterday, Adam Hurry was at Football Clichés. He, when it looked like Unai Emery was going to go to Newcastle, Sky reported, you know, that it's believed the Spanish manager thinks he has unfinished business in the Premier League. And this led to a very pedantic, nitpicky row about what constitutes unfinished business in the Premier League. And
yeah,
when do you know that your business is finished? Or, you know, so I really like those very pedantic, excruciating minutiae, picking through it. It's good fun.
Yeah, I mean, Adam has made a career out of basically picking out pedantry, and like, all power to him. Like, I tend to agree with almost everything he says.
Yeah, I mean, there is something about football pedantry, though. I think especially kind of English football pedantry, which is, I really love Adam, and, you know, I consider him a friend, and I really love what he does, and everything he says is right. That's the caveat.
Don't vote for him in the FSAs.
There's a kind of a gatekeeping element to a lot of it. You know, this is what a volley is. This is what, you know, an acceptable, you know, term for this thing is. And I think partly it's because the football public has become so diffuse and global, and there's this real kind of feeling along, I guess, what you call like legacy English football fans, to define the terms of this actually is the football, that the English football that we grew up with, that's what we know, and this is the, like, the pure authentic version of it. And what you're seeing now on, you know, Stan Sports or whatever is just some kind of, you know, it's some sort of homogenized, slightly impure version of it.
No, but you're right. Like, I have taken ownership over overhead kicks to such a ridiculous degree that whenever I wake up, someone somewhere in the world has scored an overhead kick, and someone comes to ask me what the rating is on the Sinclair spectrum.
It's about control, ultimately, right?
Yeah. A couple of times Trevor Sinclair questioned it, and I've had to tell him it's not his spectrum, it's the Trevor Sinclair spectrum. So you know, but that's probably... So, yeah, maybe it's
And as
just...
well, when there are so many people getting so riled up and genuinely enraged about far more important stuff, I suppose, like transfers and offside decisions and things like that, it's just, this is fun. It's much more fun to pick through the nitty-gritty of what constitutes a good overhead kick and what's a half volley, because it doesn't matter. It really doesn't. None of it matters, but this particularly doesn't matter.
No, and actually, the less it matters, the more it matters. Yeah. Rob says, "Hi, Max and Barry and all. With the Premier League arrival of Patson Daka, of whom I was unfamiliar prior to the season, I'd like to know if I was the only one who had a Serge Aurier moment with Mr. Daka. I was initially under the impression his name was Pat. Pat, son, Daka, which triggered some latent EastEnders-related PTSD, because I could not countenance a person being called Patson, and presume thought that Pat Butcher had joined the Premier League. I'm sure the panel has discussed this before, but can anyone tell me their favourite concatenations, not a word I understand, of other footballers' names? Jean Tigana was always confusing when I was a kid. Best wishes, Rob." I haven't given you any prep for this, so I don't know if you any have any come to mind. But I just like the idea of thinking he was called Pat. CONCACAF Nations is a series of interconnected things.
Not Manchester United then.
Yeah, very good. Bring it back to football. Chris, we were discussing how long the pod should be. It's almost certainly been too long this week. Regarding how long a pod should be, 45 minutes is fine, but centered on every single listener's personal team, says Chris. Remake every pod hundreds of times every day with, say, Scunthorpe as the lead focus, preferably with a personalized intro per listener. Easy. Fine. And this is from Rod, who says, "Hi all, thanks as always for your great company on my travels in France. I'm a 63-year-old lifelong Wolves fan and Guardianista now living in Normandy. If, as is rumoured, PSG plan to rescind Sergio Ramos's contract on account of him being totally shagged, does that prove that Mystic Barry was correct to know that he had not left Barca? Or will this only apply if and when Ramos is returned to Catalonia under the Appropriate Sale of Goods Act? Viva, viva Barry, the Mystic Meg de nos jours. En tout cas, bien cordialement, Roddy Lewis." Barry.
Merci. I was thinking about this and considering my not knowing that Sergio Ramos had left Real Madrid for PSG was, you know, really exposed me as a moron. I now think I'm some sort of genius because I think technically, even though he signed a contract, he hasn't left because he has not represented them for a minute. And it looks like he won't. And that contract, if ripped up, that will mean it never existed in the first place, so the move didn't happen.
I suppose the counter argument is you were at that exact moment being financially remunerated for appearing on a podcast entitled A Europod, all about European football. But that is, you know, once again, who is right, who is wrong, and does it really matter? And that's how we'll finish today. Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Johnny.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome. Thanks, Max.
We'll return on tomorrow. Oh, yes, tomorrow. I'm surprised myself. I should know by now. We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.